Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on this Monday, April 27th, Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. This morning, we hear more from Governor Josh Green after Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke announced she's taking a leave of absence. She received a target letter from the State Attorney General's office. It's been a week since the feds opened a portal to allow for tariff refunds. We check in with the Chamber of Commerce of Hawaii about what it's hearing from its members during these challenging times. And surf's up in the lead up to the first ever state surfing championship in our high schools. Maui will play host this weekend. And we hear from a finalist in the James Beard Awards, the Asato family, waiting anxiously for the results. Plus, history will be made on the opera stage. We talk about a Hawaii story in the Hawaiian language that takes the spotlight this weekend, the world premiere of The Sheltering Tree. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been 4 days since Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke announced she was taking an indefinite unpaid leave of absence. The decision came at the urging of Governor Josh Green after Luke received a target letter from the State Attorney General's office. She is one of at least three people targeted in an ongoing investigation into possible bribery and campaign finance violations. HPR's Ashley Mizuo spoke with Governor Green on Friday. He gave some context behind the decision for Luke to step aside and to appoint Keith Reagan as the acting lieutenant governor. Green starts with the fallout from the target letter.
As everyone knows, Lieutenant Governor has been the focus of an inquiry by the Attorney General. And when the news came out and came to me, kind of simultaneously, really, that she received a target letter, that was the signal that it was serious. I'd been worried for some time that the investigation was becoming more critical and a more serious assessment than just something basic like clerical errors. And I always, as governor, had to make the determination of whether or not it was appropriate for me to ever hand over any decision-making or significant responsibilities to anyone if there was a serious problem. The nature of getting a target letter meant that it was serious. And that's when I knew I had to speak with the lieutenant governor kind of more formally about what to do. We sat down and had a heart-to-heart conversation yesterday and discussed what possibilities there were. My opinion is that I should not be judge and jury, but I do have the responsibility to the state to make sure that any decisions we make are above reproach and that we can continue to have enough continuity and trust in any processes that go on. Once that target letter was out, it really was very difficult for me to continue to have that relationship with the LG. And so I knew that she should take a leave of absence. That's what I decided was the best course, and she agreed, because she can then go work on this with her family and her legal team and find out if they can resolve it. Meanwhile, it gives me the capacity to designate the responsibilities of the lieutenant governor to another person, in this case, Keith Reagan, who's well-known, already vetted by the Senate. That's why we picked him, among other reasons. He was also in the line of command. If a person leaves office completely, then there's a very clear chain of command. It goes, I think, speaker, then Senate president, and so on. So he would have very likely been the individual anyway, and so we thought that was the right thing to do. But that's how it played out. And it was emotional. I asked her to take a little time to think about it. She only needed about an hour. And then to Lieutenant Governor's credit, said not only was she gonna take a leave of absence, but she was gonna take an unpaid leave of absence because she didn't want to have to take advantage like some have done. Some people have taken paid leave for years. And she felt that that was inappropriate. And so I give her credit for that. And I hope that she can resolve this matter because we've had a very close relationship these last couple of years. A lot of people were saying that nothing would ever come of it because you know, there would be a conflict of interest. That was never the case, obviously. The Attorney General does her own investigation and did and is doing her own investigation. I still don't personally know any of the details of the investigation. I just know that if there was going to be something like a target letter, that was a trigger for me to have to take action.
I wanted to know what you know about the investigation that the Attorney General is investigating. How much is this target letter related to the $35,000 allegations of the exchange back in 2022? Is there anything that you can tell us about, like, kind of status, how much longer it's going to take until that's concluded?
I wish I knew more. I don't. I mean it when I say I just don't have any details that you or the listeners have. I know that when you get a target letter, it's significant, but I don't know specifically if it's about the meeting that the Lieutenant Governor had with Mr. Solidum, or if it has to do with inappropriately filed donations like we've read about. I really don't know. I also don't know how much longer it will take, except that now Lieutenant Governor will have time to focus solely on this and to, with her attorneys, work through it. My hope for anybody is, as long as they've not hurt somebody, that we come to some kind of resolution and people move forward. It makes me sad to see somebody who had such a very good career, you know, have a quick fall. But people have to be responsible for whatever they've done, and that's what's happening. I think this is actually a pretty good example that the justice system works. It worked over the course of 3 months. A lot of people wanted to go faster, but I will tell you that the Attorney General's office only has had this for 3 months. I mean, usually this takes like a year before this kind of conclusion is reached. So I've been encouraging them to go as quickly as they can, because there is an election coming up. That was obvious. The Lieutenant Governor chose over the weekend, I think, to not seek re-election. So I guess it was clear in her mind that this was going to become a bridge too far.
Do you know if, when there are other target letters sent out to other people, like, does the Attorney General let you know, like, if it gets sent to other legislators or other cabinet members, if that ever happens, like, would you be told that that's happening?
Yeah, so I spoke specifically about this with the Attorney General over the last few months, and the threshold for me is, does it affect the executive branch? So there was a time where we didn't know if the person of interest was perhaps a former legislator that was in my cabinet. And so I humbly asked the Attorney General to tell me and give me notice if it was anybody that was in a significant decision-making role in the executive branch, then I would need to know to take, you know, action. In each case, it probably would have been to take leave of absence. Because again, I should not be judge and jury, but I do have the responsibility of making sure that the decisions we make for our people are completely above board and are, you know, above reproach. So that was the standard. So she did tell me that the letter went out to the Lieutenant Governor. I was instructed to not share it with anybody, even my wife. I mean, I had to keep it to myself because that was the proper thing to do. But I had to know to prepare a decision. So the decision in my mind was pretty easy, that a leave of absence was the best course. There was a little discussion once it became public, the letter, you know, that the target letter had gone out. There was a discussion, of course, of would the Lieutenant Governor resign? Should she be asked to resign? But once again, people do have a right to be considered innocent until proven guilty or until they admit guilt. And I wanted to honor that too. I would honor that for any citizen. And the Lieutenant Governor's no exception. But because she, if I'm not available or if she has an area of responsibility, because she could be responsible for hundreds of thousands of people, especially if I traveled and she was the acting governor, it has to be a different standard. And I hold my cabinet to that same standard too. A cabinet secretary that is overseeing some large part of policy has to be held to account if there's any question. And if they clear themselves or it's resolved, then they can resume their lives. That's the nature of the judicial process.
I know one of the things that you had urged is for this investigation to wrap up kind of before elections happen in starting in August, right? Is that still the case? Like, has this satisfied that threshold? And what would, if not?
Well, it was satisfied the moment that the lieutenant governor chose not to run. So that did resolve that particular question. And I was pretty blunt about that along the way, because not only do people have, you know, a finite amount of time to, you know, to run their campaign and to have the people choose who they think is best, but also there's a filing deadline and people have to have some time to decide whether they want to throw their hat in the ring for a state Senate seat or a Congress seat or even the lieutenant governor seat. So that had to be resolved. And that's why I was starting to speak publicly as I did, that I felt that at the 3-month mark, which would have been this Monday, actually this past Monday, I felt something, some threshold, maybe not all the information, but some demarcating line of, is this or isn't this a significant issue about the lieutenant governor? Because people otherwise should have a couple weeks to decide if they want to run for lieutenant governor. Derek Kawakami is a very good guy. I have a good relationship with him, and I think he will make a terrific lieutenant governor if he's chosen and I'm chosen to continue to serve. But it would only be fair to have it resolved, fair for Sylvia, fair for other people to consider if they wanted to run. So we had this additional consideration of fairness because of these deadlines that happen really only every 4 years. I wish that the state attorney general had maybe gotten all of this in her possession last year, so she would have had more time to go through details, to come to some resolution. That would have given us all a broader capacity to deal with it. But it wasn't meant to be. I think the feds had a lot of work they were still doing, and so they couldn't turn over a lot of the data until, I guess it was January. So it was a really complicated situation. I feel very sad about it, because I don't ever like to see anyone suffering. But I also feel that kind of this is the way a democratic process is supposed to go. Enough investigation occurred that the attorney general felt she would make a serious, a serious charge or take serious action. And as soon as that became evident, it was just hours before I knew I had to take action, have at least a conversation with Sylvia. It didn't take long for her to reach the same conclusion.
Does that mean that then there are no other, you don't expect any other target letters to come down the pipeline for this investigation? I mean, isn't there a situation where someone who's running right now or is contemplating a run could also be involved in this and we not know until the full investigation has concluded?
That's possible. Frankly, I'm really focused on the executive branch races right now because the responsibility is so large. Admittedly, some legislative positions have more responsibility than others, too. But that was the most important thing. All along, I think it was pretty clear that most of the focus was on lieutenant governor. Maybe 6 weeks ago, there seemed to be some signals that it was no longer a legislator. There had been a couple of individuals in my cabinet that had fit the description, that they were still in the legislative branch at the time. That meant that they could have been the person that the attorney general was looking at. But once that was pretty clear, I just wanted some clarity so that we could pick, you know, a person in good standing that wouldn't be distracted, so that I'd have a good running mate that could do the job if I ever was unable to do it. That's the nature of the lieutenant governor role for the most part. But I also use my lieutenant governor in a vibrant capacity on big issues, as you know, like early education and broadband. So I don't take that position lightly. I didn't take it lightly when I served in the position of lieutenant governor. So this meant a lot to me. And like I said, I hope it can be resolved. But that's going to be between the lieutenant governor and the attorney general's office. Again, totally independently, I can't be judge and jury, but I can take the responsibility of state function. And that was the line that I had to walk.
We've been hearing from Governor Josh Green. He was talking with HVR's Ashley Mizzou about the ongoing state investigation into Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke. Luke has taken an unpaid indefinite leave of absence, and Green has appointed Keith Reagan as the acting Lieutenant Governor.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving Hawaii and supporting local businesses, including collaborations spotlighting local creators. Upcoming collabs at shop.zippys.com.
Today marks a week since the federal government opened a portal for companies to file for refunds after the Supreme Court struck down President Donald Trump's tariff hike, saying they were unlawful. This morning, we checked in with the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce. It's preparing to roll out a new survey of its members, given the shifting economic landscape. We talked to Chamber President Sherry Minor earlier today.
Overall, as you know, doing business in Hawaii is always challenging. We're always ranked 50th or even 49th, 50th as the best place to do business. So, you know, it's been an ongoing challenge for our local business community. So while these reimbursements help, they don't solve the broader cost challenges businesses are facing. We heard that already adjusted pricing or absorbed higher costs just to stay afloat. In fact, in a recent chamber survey on tariff impacts, some businesses reported tighter cash flow and difficulty keeping up with loan payments. As you know, and that impacts jobs. And so we're definitely concerned with the situation, and not only tariffs, but the fuel issue as well as the rising cost of goods. It's definitely getting to a tipping point for some of these businesses.
I talked to one business, and they were having such a time with their workforce, right? They don't have enough employees. And even though mm-hmm. they have successful products and all of that, it's just they can't meet the demand because they don't have enough workers.
That's also an ongoing issue of finding qualified workers to fill positions. So, you know, that will force some businesses to pivot to possibly technology. So at the chamber, we're looking at how do we implement technology or technology enablement so that businesses can learn to adjust and work more efficiently while they face this workforce challenge. From a long-term standpoint, there's a collaborative effort, public and private sector, to work on the to strengthen the talent pipeline to ensure our future workforce are prepared for the future jobs, and that's through sector partnerships and bringing the educators, the government leaders, as well as the business community together to discuss what are those skill sets necessary so that we can ensure that our workforce are prepared for high quality, high demand, high paying jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a struggle. You know, if it's not one thing, it's another. And in talking with some of the small businesses, I know, you know, they were saying that as far as these tariff refunds, you know, that it was mainly the distributors, I think, right, that are signing up. And then they're waiting to see how that all pencils out and how it filters down.
Right. It's in general the supply chain importers, right, who directly pay the tariffs and took ownership of the goods after they cleared customs. So hopefully that savings will trickle down, or the reimbursements will trickle down to the whole business pipeline. But we'll see. But again, it's much broader issue than just the tariffs. So while again, reimbursements help, they don't solve the broader cost challenges businesses are facing.
Yes, and the tariffs may be smaller in some cases after the Supreme Court, you know, struck down the legality of what President Trump tried to do initially, but it is still the added cost. And if you've got companies here that, you know, have their products made in whether it be China or Vietnam or Thailand or India, they just watch that bottom line, you know, go into the red possibly.
Yeah, Correct. You know, it's such an uncertain time right now for, you know, businesses. And as you know, businesses need certainty to ensure that they can be sustainable and continue to grow their business. But in this environment, it makes it very challenging.
And then what else can you share about that survey of your members?
Yeah, it's been consistent in terms of how they are looking at cutting costs where they can, as well as putting a freeze in hiring or perhaps eliminating positions. So there's a multitude of factors of any business that have to look at their business plan and see how they need to adjust. But we can wholeheartedly say that the tariffs have had an impact for the business community.
Have you been tracking the number of businesses that may have shut their doors down?
We do not have a succinct number, but, you know, anecdotally, we hear it on the news, right? Businesses shutting down. But we're going to see more of those stories if we don't address some of these challenges.
The other thing that's looming out there is, you know, the fuel costs. Just because of the war in Iran, people were really hoping that this would be a short one, but it's just, you know, lingering, and it's just getting tougher and tougher for countries around the globe. In Australia, they've got gas stations that don't have product. In Germany, I was reading that the price of gas is $10 a gallon. And you are having a forum in May to talk about this very thing.
Yes, we are having an energy forum with Clean Energy Office, Hoyt Gas, HECO, JIRA, and so moderated by Hawaii Business Magazine. And so, you know, we need to face these challenges and see what other options there are and start looking at these other options, because it's going to be a long-term issue. And if we don't do anything now, then it's just going to, situation is going to just get worse. So we feel that it's critical to start having a discussion, okay, what other alternative energy can we look at or pursue to ensure that we can continue to supply energy, but at a moderated cost?
And, you know, I know the Energy Office has flagged that, you know, we rely on South Korea for a lot of our jet fuel, and they get their product through the Straits of Hormuz. And, you know, we're nervously watching what impact this may have on travel.
Yes. I went to look at some ticket prices, and what a ticket normally costs $1,200, it was $1,800. So we are seeing it, and it's going to rise, and especially, you know, we rely so much on our tourism industry, and if we don't get the visitors because they decide that it's just too expensive to come here on top of the costs of being in Hawaii, that's going to have, an impact on our tourism industry and have that trickle-down impact.
Yeah, domino effect. Absolutely domino effect. We are just in such challenging times. I know that, you know, there was a lot of hand-wringing over, you know, possible recession, the R word, and it's just hard to make plans when there is so much uncertainty, you know, across the economic landscape.
Correct. And that's why for us, we invested in our 2030 blueprint, which is an economic action plan of data form. And it emphasizes the need to invest in other industries and not just tourism, but because we've seen what COVID did, we've seen the wildfires, any disasters that come in, and how reliant we are on the industry. So the blueprint is about, yes, continue to invest in tourism, but also other areas so we can be more sustainable, we can be more resilient, and we can build a much more healthy economy.
Do you think this notion, though, of the refunds on the tariffs, if the consumers at the end of the day will get that break?
We shall see. I mean, we hope. While it's a relief, some relief, that's one factor amongst all the other cost factors that are making it challenging for businesses to do business here and stay afloat and keep their doors open.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're just hearing that the businesses that rely on, you know, the packaging, you know, to come from China or Taiwan, you know, or Vietnam, just having to go to plan B and try and find something cheaper.
Yes. Exactly. And that's the environment now is to continue to find ways to pivot, to adjust, and to look at more cost-effective options.
And then what's the next plan for rollout for another survey of your members?
We hope to do one soon, in spite with the current environment, with the fuel and tariffs, and so that we can look at it from a much broader, comprehensive picture. So once we get those results, then we'll definitely let you know so we can share that information and then see what we can do to help small businesses or our local business community here.
Anything on the legislative front? Because I know we're into the last couple weeks here. Anything that you folks were advocating for?
Yeah, so we did advocate our 2030 blueprint package. But there's, you know, we're also looking at bills that we feel are concerning, such as the tax bills, any tax increases. There's one that would, I know they're discussing the budget right now, that would increase the high income earners tax by 1%. And while we look at high income earners, it's going to indirectly impact the local, small local businesses because they do file as an individual income tax. So if they make even somewhat of a profit, then they would have to pay higher taxes. And this is a time where we want to help our local business community, our small business, so that they can sustain and grow their business.
All right. Well, we'll see what comes out in the wash here. But thank you so much, Sherry.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Sherry Minor, head of the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce. We will have information on our website about that upcoming forum on fuel prices. It's to take place in Kaka'ako at the Entrepreneur Sandbox on May 12th.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
The president has said the war brought regime change in Iran. There's clearly not been a regime change. We still don't know how this new era of leadership is going to evolve. But whether the people sitting across the table from the American negotiating team are more motivated to reach a deal, I think yes, they are.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
First championship surf meet in our schools kicks off in Maui next week. It's a topic that Star Advertiser reporter Andrew Gomes is familiar with. He's a surfer and joins us this morning. Hi, Andrew. How you doing?
Hi. I'm good, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you were out at Kiwalo's when the Oahu high schoolers were out competing.
Right. It was their championship. Happened Monday a week ago. And yeah, really, they packed the park with more than 100 students from 20 public schools on the island, and they had an all-day event. I think it kicked off at about 8, ran till 3 or so, maybe later. But yeah, there were a lot of happy students competing on the waves, which were great shape that day as well. Good size, great shape.
Oh, terrific. Oh, they must have been stoked. You know, and I know this has been a long time in coming. And, you know, I think when Carissa Moore put Hawaii on the map, right, at the Olympics, that was pretty stunning for everybody. And it's like, hey, we need to do right by the kids who have an interest in this sport and really give it its due.
Right. No bigger stage than the Olympics for a sport born in Hawaii. Yet on the flip side, high school students except for Maui, for a good number of years. Outside of Maui, high school students couldn't participate except for club-level surf events. And so that was, you know, kind of something that bothered a lot of surfers, students, that such a thing wasn't a statewide high school sport, but now it is.
I know that the buzz must just have been incredible on the other islands as the kids were competing.
Yeah, this past Monday's event was the championship meet for Oahu Public Schools, but there are five regional athletic associations, Big Island, Kauai, Maui, and then in addition to the public schools on Oahu, a private school association. And they've all had three or four contests since February, March, and earlier this month, culminating in a regional association championship. I think a couple are still yet to be held, perhaps, or were held this past weekend. And, you know, the top scorers from those regional contests, the championship contests, will head over to Ho'okipa on Maui Friday and Saturday to surf off for a state title.
And so how does this work then? The kids provide their own surfboards, or do they get funding to get those boards? I don't really know much about that.
I'm not sure about funding. My understanding was most of the student athletes have been surfing and didn't just start to compete, but recreationally. They've got equipment, they go surfing. Now they get to compete against other students at other schools. So, yeah, that's what's new is the organized and sanctioned events. A good number of schools had clubs, volunteer coaches, competitions, but other than Maui, which has had surfing as a league sport since, I think it was 2014, you know, no other schools on other islands have been able to participate in a sanctioned event by the Hawaii High School Athletic Association.
Well, I think this weekend is just going to be such a blast, you know, knowing that it has taken all this time to watch this come together as a sanctioned school sport. Are you flying over?
Yeah, I am not. My colleague Dave Reardon, I think, has plans. He's a sports reporter and columnist. I believe he has plans to go. But yeah, it should be a fun long event.
All right.
A lot of happy students, and I, you know, administrators seem really pleased as well that you know, it's taken off.
Yes, finally. Well, thank you so much, Andrew.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Andrew Gomes about the upcoming State Surf Championships. 127 high schoolers are competing with divisions in shortboards, longboards, and bodyboarding. You can read Andrew Gomes' story at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, committed to supporting Hawaii food producers and makers. Learn more about its locally sourced Mountain Apple brand products at ktasuperstores.com.
The satirical newspaper The Onion is taking over InfoWars, the media empire created by right-wing blowhard Alex Jones, and replacing the hate with comedy. Why?
I think people need to hear other people like me remind the world that this is insane. Otherwise, people feel like they're going crazy and that they're alone.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Hawaii has one finalist in the James Beard Awards nominations this year, and it's the Sherbet King himself, Neil Asato. Out of the nine local chefs selected for the semifinal round, Asato, who was nominated for Outstanding Pastry Chef or Baker, was the only one to make it past the semifinals. HBR contributor Sarah Bouchard recently met with Asato to learn more about the family's new shop in Waikiki, where listeners can find their pints now that their Pali shop is closed, and who will be going to Chicago to attend the Oscars of the restaurant industry.
Our whole family is going to Chicago, so we're just super excited to make a family trip and experience the whole James Beard scene.
Why do you think that you guys got the final nomination out of everybody? And was this something that you guys were shooting for?
It just totally caught us off guard for the semifinalists. I had no idea we could even be nominated for it. So getting the finalists, I don't know, I'm kind of speechless. I still don't really know what's going on. We're just super grateful for the honor and the recognition for our family's hard work over the years.
Yeah. How did you guys get started in this business? And I know you were cooking, that your background involves cooking, but how did you start getting more into desserts?
Yeah, our whole family, like, kind of grew up in the restaurant industry. So we all had a background working and kind of cooking. We used to live in Maui when we were kids, when I was in preschool. So we used to always go to Tasaka Goody Goody. And when we came back to Oahu, we kind of missed it. So we'd always make sherbet and like ice cream at home. So it's kind of like when I wanted to do my own food business, I wanted to make something fun that was like nostalgic, and Goody Goody kind of came up. So I started working on my own homemade sherbet recipes and ice cream, and then started selling it just to friends and family. And it just kind of organically grew over the years.
And I know that you guys kind of started out in like a warehouse in Halawa, right? And then from there, you had your first shop, and that was located where?
That was on Pali Highway. So it kind of worked out to be a good location, coming down Pali right into downtown. And we're the only kind of shop open on Sunday, so people could kind of find us when there was a line in the beginning. But yeah.
Yeah, like a long line, right?
Yeah, it took a while to get there, but yeah, the first couple months were slower, and then it slowly picked up after we had a little more media coverage, and we only could make a little, so it would sell out quickly. That was like the thing. So you had to come early to get your sherbet.
Yeah, it was in high demand. And I think one of the things that the locals especially appreciated was the kind of flavors that you guys made. So tell me about your direction as far as what kind of flavors you make and why.
Yeah, we definitely like look back to like all of our childhood favorites, like a bunch of candy flavors, lihimoi things. So our auntie in Maui had a little candy, like a general store. So she had an icy machine. So we would drink a ton of icy and mix things into it. And we kind of grew up in Kaimuki area near Kaimuki Crack Seed. So we'd always go and get all the different lihimois and lemon peel and the icy. So just looking back at all those flavors, and then we just recreated into sherbet and sorbet form was kind of the inspiration.
So super nostalgic for Hawaii. And you just opened a location in Waikiki inside of the Hyatt. Tell me about how that shop is different than the original shop and what sort of special offerings that you now do out of that.
Yeah, so we're located in Kings and Queens. It's right across the Duke statue in the Hyatt Regency. It's like our first time scooping our product. So it's like a little scoop shop, and then we have a little bar built out. So it's like a 4-seat bar top that we do like a dessert omakase tasting that includes, we do like a tasting of like a crack seed store. So there's lihimoi and lemon peel, like different types for people to try along with our candies. And then another small bite, and then we do like a seasonal shave ice offering. So it's kind of like Japan inspired kakigori style, but with like Hawaii flavors. So it's just kind of combining a bunch of nostalgic flavors and making it fun and kind of interactive for all the guests.
Yeah. Do you have to have a reservation to do the omakase?
Yep. So right now it's reservation only. We do it through Open Table, and we do a 2 and a 4 p.m. seating. But we plan to expand it as we keep going to more hours, and maybe we'll do walk-up shave ice in the future.
I know. And then you have a variety of packaged candies, too, that people can buy, right? And talk to me about those.
Yeah, the candies. Yeah, we just thought it'd be fun kind of takeaway for people to take home as little gifts. So a lot of the candies we do it as in sorbet form also. So it's kind of like the same flavor profiles, and but just as candy so they can take it home. Because, yeah, our products are hard to take home frozen to mainland or even outer island sometimes.
That's pretty genius. So visitors can take the flavor home without, you know, trying to worry about melting sherbet. What are your future plans? Is Waikiki like the start of something more? Are there more of these shops in your future?
No, we're still trying to decide. We just recently closed our poly shop for our retail pint pickups on Sunday. And we're kind of focusing on wholesale through Foodland, expanding our wholesale. So we started doing Ala Moana this past week, Ala Moana Foodland, Pearl City, we do Kapolei and Aina Haina. And then we've been shipping to Maui once a month, and we ship to Hilo once a month too. So the production out of that little poly shop is really hard for us. So we're just trying to focus on wholesale and then look for like a bigger bigger warehouse space for us industrial to really increase production. And then we can open another like a retail shop for the community. Yeah. So we're looking for a spot right now.
Have you seen a increase in business since the James Beard nomination?
Well, yeah, definitely in Waikiki, people do mention it that they saw us and then they came to seek us out in Waikiki or even at Foodland. Some of them said they want to go look for pints. Oh. So it's been an amazing exposure for our brand.
And that's locals, visitors, or both?
Well, it's both. I think definitely a lot of the tourists that come to our tasting, maybe a good 20% maybe saw us on James Beard and then they booked the experience. And then just all the locals that know us just came to say congratulations, and it just feels amazing that to be recognized for the award.
I mean, you guys have been in the community a long time, so I'm sure people are just so stoked for you. What are some of the restaurants that you guys used to work at back in the day, just so we know?
Our family's restaurants, like it goes back way back. So it's like my grandparents. So the longest one was in Kaimuki. It was called Victoria Inn. That's where Cocoa Head Cafe is now. So it was the three floors. So we used to work the banquets upstairs. My parents in high school, they used to wait tables. And then we've been helping until they closed. And my grandparents had like Manoa Grill. My parents actually opened their own little plate lunch spot in Kalihi, kind of by where Ethel's was, before they had me for like a year. And then my dad went back to construction and my mom just went back to work somewhere. But our family's always been in restaurants, and I thought I was going to want to be a chef maybe 16 years ago. Well, I wanted to open a food truck when the food truck scene was booming. So I did actually buy a truck and I was working on it. Then I went to work at Vintage Cave. It was like my first professional restaurant. And then I went to help open some other restaurants in like Chinatown, like with a Livestock Tavern, and just a bunch of amazing experiences that helped like shape just my culinary journey and help figure out what I want to do, and met a lot of great people through it. So
why did you decide to take the leap and go into business with your family?
I started it by myself at first, but it was kind of just like a home side project to see where it would go. And my mom came on when we moved to Halava. She was retiring from the DOE, and then the whole family started helping as it grew, and now we're finally starting to hire outside of family. And wow. It's been great. It's hard to work with family sometimes, but they work the hardest for sure.
So, you know, this is like a super grassroots business that you started out of your house, kind of, right? Yeah. And then just over time with really hard work, just perseverance, I feel like you guys just grew and grew and grew, and look where you are now. It's so exciting.
It's hard to... when I first was starting at home, it was really just to make extra money to help support my family. And then it's just been a personal growth and growing with the business and trying to learn and just grateful for the opportunity.
We've been hearing from Asato Family Shop owner Neil Asato. He spoke with HBR's contributor, Sarah Burchard. The James Beard Awards ceremony will take place in Chicago on June 15th. How countdown to May 1st, Friday. That's when the first opera in the native Hawaiian language will premiere at the Blaisdell Concert Hall. HPR's Cassie Ordonio caught a recent rehearsal and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so I bet they're getting excited.
Yeah, they are very excited. When I was at the rehearsals, you get to see everything enunciated in Olelo Hawaii. And I know this opera is mostly primarily in the Hawaiian language, but you're actually going to hear some opera in both English and French as well. So you'll get like a mixture of everything. But I know this is the first opera in the Hawaiian language that will debut on the main stage. It was beautiful to see. It was a packed room. I spent last Tuesday at the Hawaii Opera Theater, which is right across the street from Thomas Square. It's a diverse group. There was a mixture of like non-native Hawaiian speakers and then native Hawaiian speakers. There's some folks, it's mostly a local cast, and others is actually from around the world, according to Patrick Makuakane, who's the director and choreographer of this upcoming opera.
So many beautiful pieces of music. The first 3 days through rehearsal, I just had to get through it and stop crying because I was an emotional mess, because I'm just enjoying the incredible score that Herb Mahalona wrote. But it's also part of our history that was never told. It's the first opera about Hawaiian history, and we get to be included in this story this time rather than looking at somebody else's story. We're a part of the story. A story that's really important that very few people have heard about.
So what is the story?
So this is actually the untold story of Timoteo Ha'olilio. He was a friend of King Kamehameha III and the royal secretary, and he played a vital role in securing Hawaii as a sovereign nation by going to Great Britain, the United States, to secure treaties with them just to recognize Hawaii as an independent nation in 1843. So he actually got sick coming back home to Hawaii, so he never really got to see Hawaii actually fully recognized before he got home. He died of tuberculosis, according to documents from Kamehameha schools. But, you know, because this is the first opera sung in Olelo Hawaii on the main stage, you would think that the Hawaiian monarchs were actually very into classical music and the arts, but there hasn't really been an opera composed in the Hawaiian language. The closest one was the unfinished operetta written in English by Queen Liliʻuokalani, and I got to talk to DeSoto Brown. He's the Bishop Museum historian and curator of the Archives Department.
Mohailani, which is the name of her operetta, was performed in English according to the pages of her written document that still exist. So it was in English, but Hawaiian music was performed, hula was performed in the course of the operetta, but the dialogue was not in the Hawaiian language. It was in English. And again, Liliʻu was completely fluent in both English and Hawaiian. She learned both from when she was a very young age, starting when she was 3 or 4 years old. So she was equally fluent in either language. She could have written her operetta to be in Hawaiian, but she didn't choose to do so. She chose to write it in English. And I'm sure that's because she was thinking of, if she ever did complete it, she wanted it to be performed for the widest audience possible, which would have taken in primarily people who spoke and understood the English language.
I just had a crazy thought. What if someone could finish that operetta and include the native Hawaiian language? I mean, wow, that would be powerful.
That's still kind of in the works, actually. DeSoto Brown said that there's actually a researcher from Canada who's still piecing together Queen Liliʻuokalani's operetta. The reason why it's taking so long is because this is actually a rough draft that she was doing, you know, during her last years of her life. And what she would do is that they were kind of written on like these like very small scraps pieces of paper, and how she edited, she would basically kind of put another paper and copy and paste it over. And so that's why it's all scattered between Bishop Museum and the Hawaii State Archives. So that researcher has a lot on her plate right now. But for those who don't know the difference between an operetta and an opera, there's actually a pretty stark difference. Operetta is typically shorter than an opera, and it's more theatrical, more lighthearted. There's dialogue, so there's speaking lines, there's dancing, but opera is more serious, it's longer, and you're singing throughout the whole entire performance rather than speaking your lines. But it was really cool to see the cast actually perform it in Olelo Hawaii. And not only that, they're going to be dancing hula as well. This is something that Patrick Mokuakane told me that was kind of a challenge, was not just enunciating the words in the Hawaiian language, but trying to do hula as well into the opera, because they're going to be wearing kind of like these heavy costume designs and move on stage. And they're probably pretty hot on stage. But also, to project from the diaphragm to thousands of people is what opera trainers have trained for years for. And one opera singer that I spoke to was Quinn Kelsey. He's a longtime baritone singer who's been singing opera specifically at 13 years old, and he will play Timoteo Ha'alilio.
One thing that I've sort of discovered is that, and I've mentioned this to a few people, whenever I've sung in Hawaiian before this, I liken it to, I mean, when you think of Hawaiian music, you think of parties and a really relaxed kind of atmosphere. And it's so unlike the focus in the voice that I use when I sing opera. And so, you know, we're in rehearsals and I start singing in Olelo Hawaii and my voice just naturally disconnects, if you will, from my operatic training. And so I have to stop myself and go, wait. No, we have to merge these two. So that's been a funny challenge. The language has always been comfortable, and so there hasn't been a problem there. But you know, I've never sung opera in this capacity. So yeah, as I say, you know, to merge the two has been its own kind of a happy challenge.
Yeah, he was talking about that little discomfort when we had him on the show with Patrick earlier this month. I'm sure that it's going to be, you know, just incredible to behold on stage.
And just last night, I checked that tickets are still available, but the Sunday night tickets are limited availability.
Okay. All right. And I know they've got a combined discount, so folks should take this opportunity for this world premiere.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio. Check out her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Does it for us today. Tomorrow we plan to take a closer look at efforts to manage the growing popularity of Ho'omalehea Botanical Gardens. Got ideas about that? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast. Search for it on Spotify or Apple, or head to our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.